Mackenzie.
Lamar.
I'm really fucking depressed after watching this movie.
Dude. Yes.
It's heavy. I know Marriage Story was in the mix this month, and we were like, no, too much of a downer. And then we chose this one instead, and I don't think there's much of a difference.
There's really not much of a difference. I was thinking that as I was watching it, I was like, you know what? They're pretty comparable. They're pretty comparable in feels.
So to start things out today, I wanted to do something light because I feel like this one's going to be pretty heavy. So before we get into our feels, I was thinking randomly it popped into my head that there's been a lot of movies that have the word blue in the title. It just seems to be one of those colors that gets thrown into movie titles. I don't know. But I want to quiz you. So I've pulled up this list. I think it's on Ranker of the best quote unquote movies with blue in the title. And so what I want you to do is put 2 minutes on a timer over there, and then I'm going to give you single word clues to the title of the movie. It could be something having to do with the plot. It could have to do with the title itself. It could be maybe the name of an actor or actress in it. But again, only a single word. So we're going to do our best in 2 minutes and see how many of these I can get you to guess. And I'll skip if I feel like you're not going to get it.
Okay.
All right.
Tell me when.
Are you ready?
As ready as my brain can be today. Yes.
Okay. So remember, all of them have the word blue in the title. Here we go. Ready, set, go. Fabric.
Blue velvet.
Yes. Swimming.
Blue crush. Although, isn't that surfing?
That's, yeah. Maybe I'll get to surfing later, but this is another one. Swimming.
What is a good swimming one? I don't know. Skip.
Okay, skip. Earth.
Earth.
Earth. What about documentary? Does that help? Earth documentary?
Isn't it blue? Like, isn't there one called just Earth? Blue Earth?
You're close. You just need the second word.
I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know.
How about Alba? ALBA.
As in the actress? Oh, what has she been in that was bluish? She wasn't Jews in is it in the into the blue?
Yes.
The blue?
Yes.
Okay.
With Paul Walker. Okay. Lesbians.
Blue is the warmest color.
Yeah. Nailed it. Sharks.
No, I wanted to say Blue Lagoon, but I don't.
That was the last, the swimming one.
Oh, sharks. Okay. Deep Blue Sea?
Yes. Okay, you already got Blue Crush. Racing? Wait, maybe not. I don't know that movie. Okay, pass.
I love that you passed for me. That's my favorite.
Hugh. H-U-G-H.
Hugh. Blue.
This is kind of a obscure film.
Blue Jasmine? Was he in Blue Jasmine?
He was not, but that's on the list. I didn't give a clue for that one. All right, last one just because I want to say it. I don't know if you remember 90s television. It's okay. Can you get that one?
Do it again.
Martin.
No.
Such a 90s television reference. So it's Martin.
I was going to say.
Yeah. but he was in Blue Streak. So let's see. You got
Blue Streak. I know Blue Streak, but I didn't get the reference.
No worries. So you got Blue Velvet.
What was the Hugh Grant? What is it? Hugh Grant?
Mickey Blue Eyes.
Oh,
which is like obscure. He like marries into the mob or some shit.
I know that movie too, so I do know that.
Well, you got Blue Velvet. We eventually got Blue Lagoon. You didn't get Blue Planet. That was the documentary.
Oh, duh.
Got Into the Blue. You got Blue Jasmine. Blue is the warmest color. Deep Blue Sea. I think we did pretty good. You got Blue Crush even without me giving the surfing clue. So, and then
that was one of the first ones that pops into my head when you say like movies with blue in it. It's like blue is the warmest color, and Blue Crush, and the rest were I was reaching. Which
I didn't realize how difficult
them,
it
actually.
Was. Yeah, like. It's very difficult in when you're under pressure to string together a single word clue to a movie title with another word. Like it's we didn't even get to Elvis number 22, Blue Hawaii. Didn't even get there.
Oh, Blue Hawaii.
We did okay. I'm happy with this. Now let's get sad.
Well, let's get sad. Yeah, let's get sad. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm depressed.
Yes, he's also Lamar. Yeah. And we're wrapping up Love Stinks Month with one that really
probably
is
the worst.
We're really closing it out with a bang, is what I would say. Blue Valentine. And I will just caveat this with, I am quite ill today as well. So I will sound quite somber. I will not look great. There's no makeup. In fact, this one, let's just not upload the video to Spotify. I'm just saying.
I think you look fine for the record. So
thank you. But I, for that reason, will not be drinking our cocktail this week. But Mr. Lamar will be, and I will be joining with Blue Gatorade. I did bring some Gatorade. So
your drink is bluer than mine. So
yeah. So really, yeah. I'm on theme and you're not. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, blame what? Skyler.
Exactly. So what are we drinking? What'd you decide?
So at Craft World mixed this up for, the way he described it is, it's a riff on a Martinez, which is an OG cocktail that was a riff on a Manhattan and inspired the martini. So there's a lot of history in this one, but essentially this is 1.5 ounces of Empress gin, which is that purple one with the pea flower in it. 1.5 ounces of sweet vermouth, 0.25 ounces of Luxardo maraschino liqueur, 0.25 ounces of honey syrup, and two dashes of Ango bitters. Orange peel for garnish. I didn't have oranges. But this is one of the rare ones. I almost made the mistake. You don't shake this one. You stir it up and then you strain it.
Strain it.
But yeah, it came out like, and I think this is what the picture looked like. It's more like, I thought it would be purpler or bluer with the Empress in there. But yeah, I think the honey syrup and the vermouth made it very brown. But yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty goop.
And we are calling this Cold Comfort. Mm-hmm. Which I didn't know that term. You sent me the thing and I had to read the definition for it. Cold comfort actually means a false sense of comfort in a relationship that has lost its warmth. Very fitting for this movie.
Yeah, and cold and blue and I don't know, it all makes sense.
I'd only ever heard ex-girlfriends call me that, a cold comfort. So I had some assumptions, but you gave me the definition. So.
I can't imagine why. I can't imagine why. All right, cheers. I'm cheersing you with Gatorade. I think it's not bad luck if it's Gatorade.
I think it's only water that's bad luck.
Yeah, it's only water that's bad luck.
That's good. That's, I guess, the
do you like it? I was worried about you liking it because
it's
the,
quite sweet
because
of the sweet vermouth, honey syrup, and Luxardo all in there. So it actually, I don't know what to describe, like what to compare it to, but it's going down very smooth and sweet. So
I was very curious about it, but I obviously cannot drink it. And you guys were chatting back and forth. And I just checked out. I was like, I don't know. Whatever you guys decide, have a great time. So I'll have to find out another time. But anyways, you drink that for the both of us because this is a rough one. So we're going to give you some basics and it's going to be pretty easy this week, hopefully, because there aren't a lot of people that we really interact with this, in this one. And then we're going to give you a spoiler warning, I guess, because I mean, I don't know that you guys will watch this if you haven't seen it already, but we'll do it. So this is Blue Valentine 2010. It seemed newer than that in my head, but it's actually been 15 years since this came out. But anyways,
it's kind of like Gosling was in a weird place at this time. Cause I feel like he's really in the A-list in the last 5 to 10 years is when he's been doing a lot of just high profile stuff. And I mean, he's always been a star, but this was like that kind of midpoint in his career before he had sort of his renaissance. So
I feel like he was in the phase of trying to make himself do things that were different than the rom-commy stuff, right? Yes. Like different than The Notebook. Cause it's important to note, this is post Notebook. And so he had been doing a few things at this time that were pretty unique. There was Half Nelson? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So like he had done a few things around this time that were like a little bit different, a little bit more indie. And this is definitely an indie film in terms of budget and, you know, the way that it was shot and things like that. So yeah, this was very well received though. So like the ratings are 7.3 out of 10 on IMDb, 87% from critics, 77% from audiences. So, I mean, really well received, especially for something that's such a rough subject matter, to be honest. Usually people don't go to the movies just to be sad. And, yeah, you're going to be sad.
I want to know, listeners out there, are there people who really love this movie who have watched it more than once? Because I feel the same as we said about Marriage Story. I watched that once. I was like, that was an experience. It was very good, but I never want to watch that again. And that's how I kind of feel about this. So if you're out there and you really love rewatching this, maybe it's cathartic. But yeah, just a bummer of a film.
I have seen it before, but I think only maybe once or twice before.
Okay.
And I wasn't particularly looking forward to rewatching it. Don't get me wrong, but I think that assessment is on point of it's really good. It's very well done. It's beautifully acted. It's very poignant,
mm-hmm.
but man, it just hurts the whole time. Anyway, so, okay. So the director here is Derek Cien France. I don't know if that's how we say it.
It's a very unique last name. I don't know.
Last name. Like, I have a lot of questions. Yeah. Anyway, he directed it and he also partially wrote it. And he's done a few things that I am unaware of, but you checked it out.
I was going to say, this might be the first movie we've done where the directors and the two other writers of this, who are Joey Curtis and Cami Delevingne, I haven't seen anything else that any of them have done. Might be the first time that that's happened, because I have not seen The Place Beyond the Pines. I've heard it's pretty good, like, okay.
I've seen it. I remember it being good, but okay. It's been a long time since I saw it.
Yeah, haven't seen that. And then the one thing that I have heard of the directors, is The Sound of Metal, and that's still on my queue. Like, I've been meaning to watch it for 2 years.
Very good.
Yeah, so, and he was a co-writer on that, so I don't know how much of the script he actually did. But the other two, I have not seen a single thing that they've done, so...
Yeah, I haven't seen a couple of these. These were kind of new for me, but like he's done a couple of things, you know, as far as writing as well. He did The Light Between Oceans. Did you ever see that?
Nope. Like I said, yeah. I went through his entire IMDb and was like, I've seen none of this, unless
that
it was
one sounded
a production.
Really familiar to me, so I felt like I should have seen it, but I have never seen it.
Derek is also apparently really close friends with Ryan Gosling, which kind of makes sense since they've worked together twice. So that it might be like one of those things where knowing the right people, you know, not to say he's not talented because he's making good stuff, but yeah,
right. But you know, just working with people that you know and that you like and all of that. So yeah. So to your point, there was also Joey Curtis was another writer on here, but I agree. I haven't seen much of her stuff. I doubt that a lot of people have. There's a lot of like some TV writing, 21st Century Dialogues, Girl on the Edge was one, and then 2307 Winter's Dream, but I haven't seen any of those. And then Cami Delevingne, same thing. She did something called Phone Stack. Not sure if other people have heard of that. And then same thing, some other TV series, but the one that people maybe have seen recently is American Gigolo. So there was like a reboot that was turned into a series. And she also did Homecoming, which was on Amazon Prime for a while. And that's also very depressing. So it kind of all checks out to me.
Got a lot of feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Our major cast crew, very small. We have Mr. Ryan Gosling, as we said, plays Dean. He's done a bazillion things, as we've said before on the podcast.
Yeah, we've covered him before with like Drive. The Fall Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. All
the one thing I did want to call out that I found in my exploration, and I kind of remembered this from when I was a kid, but he's one of the few actors to have been in both Are You Afraid of the Dark and Goosebumps. He was in an episode of each. And apparently he turned down a potential role as one of the actual recurring characters on Are You Afraid of the Dark, the Midnight Society, like the kids telling the stories. He turned that down to go be on the Mickey Mouse Club, which I think makes sense. It rounds your talents out a little bit when you get the singing and the dancing and the acting, as opposed to just sitting around a campfire for 5 minutes a week.
Which he did awesome at. And you see it here and in a bunch of his other work. You know, you see him doing it in La La Land. You see it in this. You see it in Barbie. You see, he's really pulled it through that Mickey Mouse Club experience. Michelle Williams, obviously. And I can't remember if we've talked about her on the pod before, but she's great. She plays Cindy. She's done a bunch of really interesting things, not just Dawson's Creek back in the day. She did My Week with Marilyn, where she did, I think, a really good job of playing Marilyn. If you
didn't, she has like 5 Oscar noms. She hasn't won yet, but she has 5 different, like, between supporting and actress, and that's one of them. And it just blew me away that she has so many noms.
She's chosen her roles really well, I think. Like, the ones that, like, she's got a very diverse repertoire, really. She does a really great job. She was also in Manchester by the Sea.
Another fucking downer of a movie.
Another one where I was like,
I don't want to watch this a second time.
Yeah, well, same thing. Well done. And check, saw it, you know, yeah.
She was also in Halloween H2O. I don't know if that's one that she got an Oscar nom for, but that's like the second best Halloween movie, so... Yeah,
man, she was overlooked then, huh, for that H2O. She was also in The Fablemans, which is a little bit more recent if people have seen
it. Speaking about picking your roles right.
She played playing Steven Spielberg's mom in that, which he has a very interesting, unique relationship with his mom in both the film and in real life, in the way that he talks about her. And she apparently, he felt like she really captured it.
And she's also a woman of your own heart. When I look at all the books behind you, she's a huge book collector. She has a first edition Great Gatsby. So you and her, there's your icebreaker right there.
That's so cool. And fun fact, we have the same initials. I just realized for some reason.
Oh my God. You guys should be besties.
We're going to be hashtag besties. Michelle, give me a call. All right. John Doman plays Jerry. He's really the only other person we see on repeat at all. And he's just been in a, he's been in a few TV things that are very well known, most notably The Wire.
Yeah, Ross, a dickhead.
Yeah, yeah. Huge total asshole. Douche canoe, yeah. Total douche canoe, 100%. But then he was also in, for as far as films, he was in The Trial of the Chicago 7, which was very good if you've never seen
it. I watched that on an airplane. I kind of wish I hadn't because it was so good. And an airplane on those tiny screens isn't the best place to but that was great.
Yeah, it was really well done. Okay, so quick plot summary here. The relationship of a contemporary married couple charting their evolution over a span of years by cross-cutting between time periods.
Sure.
Accurate? Short?
Yeah.
Really?
There's no mention of the tears that you're going to shed when you watch it. I wish
they don't like tee you up for you're going to be really sad. Yeah. But
normally I don't want spoilers in the description, but I feel like that would have helped in this case. Like, spoiler, you will cry or at least be very sad.
Yeah, you'll just be sad, 100%. Well, so a couple quick production notes on this one. This is really interesting how it was chosen where to film. So you see we have kind of like a Brooklyn, Pennsylvania area. Mm-hmm. This was all chosen to be filmed so that Michelle Williams could be in proximity to her home in Brooklyn because Heath Ledger, her previous partner, had just recently passed and she didn't want to be away from her daughter. So she needed to be able to be at home and take care of their daughter. So literally Derek, the director, put a compass on a map and did a circle around her home. And that was the filming vicinity. So
that was nice. So now I feel bad for saying I haven't seen any of his other stuff because that's very sweet of him. Yeah,
it is sweet of him. So anyway, I thought that was really interesting. And it was also really a limited budget. It was $1 million budget for this film. And we have two pretty solid actors, not as famous as they are now, but still pretty established. Obviously, again, Ryan Gosling had already done The Notebook. So like we're talking two very expensive resources at the top. So they only had a $1 million budget. It still made $16.5 million in the theaters.
I wonder if Gosling just did this as a favor to his buddy. He was like, don't even pay me. This one's on the house, you know?
He did get paid, but funny you say that. Derek didn't. So it came down to the end of it. Actually, he had gotten paid. So he had gotten paid out of the budget. They were getting towards the end of production and they were basically short the amount of his fee is what he said. And he essentially paid it back into the production. And he goes, and funnily enough, if you think about it, I had to pay taxes on that because it was income. So kind of in effect, I paid to make this movie. So it was like this poor man.
I hope he's
and it also
good
took years to
residuals.
Get made. Yeah, really? Hopefully he's getting residuals, yes, because he did not make bank on this. But yeah, he went all in on this one for sure.
You hear about that with a lot of directors. I remember Kevin Smith was doing a speech and talked about how to make Clerks. He literally just took out like 10 credit cards and he had to fake how much income he had to get approved for them. So he would like give the number of his workplace, like the video store or whatever. But when the people called, he would pretend to be the manager and say, Kevin Smith, he makes, you know, $60,000 a year or whatever to get approval, and just put himself in tens of thousands of dollars of credit card debt to make Clerks. So you hear about that of people just want to see their vision realized and they're betting on themselves to win.
And I think that was kind of how I felt about this. Like he just really wanted to tell this story. I mean, he's been interviewed about it a couple of times. He wanted to tell what this feels like, what this looks like. And I think he had a very distinct vision and it took years to get made and he just stuck with it. And again, it didn't make him a ton of money, but he wanted to see it and he was very happy with how it came out from what he said. So
wasn't this sort of like inspired by his experience seeing his parents divorce? Am I wrong about that?
I think it was it's something along those lines of like his parents' relationship devolving, something like that. And I think that he also like shows that in her parents' relationship in the film as well a little bit. So
also one thing that I wanted to say at the very beginning, was I think it helps that there's a female writer involved in this. I think having Cami Delevingne here, it's very important that you get a female perspective on this. Without spoiling anything, the first half of the movie, I'm sitting here like, oh yeah, his character is a cool guy.
He's great.
As it goes on, you're just seeing it from her perspective more and more of, yeah, so we could save that. But I think it's very important that there was a female writer involved in this.
Yeah. And I think like you root for both of them at different times. Yes. I think the thing that you run into in the story that makes it really interesting. So, all right. Well, with all that in mind, two warnings this time. Spoiler warning, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time. Trigger warning. I have been married and divorced, and it's really dark and twisty sometimes, and these kinds of movies make all that come out. So I'm going to have some commentary and some feelings today. Okay. So just letting everybody know. Also, this movie is just sad in and of itself, even if you haven't been through that. So yeah. Just heads up.
Well, we appreciate the honesty. So we open on an idyllic couple, very happy, doing super well, daughter, dog, great situation, right?
Mm-hmm. Adorable. Super adorable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're, you know, you can almost sense the tension immediately. And I think it's such an important choice, actually, so that you kind of know you're not in for a love story, at least in the way that is in the traditional sense. Because, and I was thinking about this later, not to digress too much, but it says on the tagline for Blue Valentine, it says Blue Valentine, a love story, and it has a heart in it. And I remember for years being like, it's not a love story. Like, what a crock of shit. Like, what false advertising? But like, it is a love story. And that's the reality, is like a lot of love stories do go this way. It doesn't make them less of a love story because they ended or because it changed. It still had love in it at some point. And we absolutely see that. We see the love in this story. But it's not, it's a non-traditional love story. And I think that's kind of what makes it interesting, is that you know it's not going to end from the first frame. You know it's not going to end well. And it makes you wonder, like, how did we get here from the first frame?
Yes. I remember 5 or so years ago, before Janelle and I started dating, like talking to friends of mine and older folks that I know about their marriages. I was trying to figure out what love was. And it's like, am I being too picky about not wanting to settle down and all this stuff? And I remember constantly hearing this advice of, marriage is difficult and you have to wake up every day and choosing to love this person, no matter how, when they're on their bad days, when you guys aren't getting along, when there's friction, it is a job essentially to make a marriage work. It's a different kind of love than what we see when they're younger here. It's not this passionate, like everything is new honeymoon period. It's still love, but it's definitely requires work. And at least half of the people in this relationship in the movie not putting in the work is what's causing things to fall apart.
Yeah. And I think it's so easy to forget that part. Like, it's good. And I've also had similar advice from people in the past of like, don't forget, marriage is work, marriage is work. And I think it's so important to call that out, because if you think about just pop culture and media, and whether it be in film or in other things, whatever it is, we always show the falling in love part. Yeah. We very rarely show the living in love part, you know, the choosing to live afterwards with this person. Yeah. Like, and not to simplify to just Disney movies, but you know what I mean? It's like, oh, here's all the romance. And then they got married and that's the end of the story, literally. Mm-hmm. So it's not the end of the story. And I think the love stories that stand the test of time are people who really did go through hard times or had periods where it was very hard to love that person, and they powered through and they worked really hard at it and they found the things that they loved in each other. And I think the story of this couple is that they can't do that, and or they forget to do that, however you want to say it is. But over the years, they're making big and small compromises, and they're building up this subtle resentment towards one another because of that. And they're numbing it with various things, whether it's drinking or having a kid and putting all your effort into the kid, or just work and getting validation from work and whatever it is. There's all these factors that make them forget that they loved this person once. You know, they're almost out of focus. I feel like it seemed like they were not each other's focus kind of when we first see them and the dog gets out, and the first reaction when we find out what's happened to the dog from him to her is, how many fucking times did I tell you to lock the gate? And like, she's already devastated. She's already upset, she's already devastated that the dog is gone and that they're going to have to tell their daughter and all the things. And she, you know, she feels extreme guilt if it is because she left the gate open, which is never like, you don't know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But he can't show her compassion in that moment and be like, oh, I'm so sorry you found her like that. Or, oh God, what, like how terrible that she got out. Like just whatever. He can't do that. He can just place blame. He can just be frustrated.
Yeah. Janelle and I agreed that this might be the least likable Ryan Gosling's ever been in a role, which if his goal was to not be typecast as the lover boy in The Notebook, this is
the perfect
role.
He did a great job. Yeah, this was awesome, a great pendulum shift for sure.
Showed the range. And it's just, you know, it's an inability to sort of mature and grow up is what we see from him, because he's very aloof and lighthearted and doesn't have a care in the world early on, and he's charming. But it's like, eventually you need to grow beyond that, and it's not enough to just be a cool dad. You have to still be a good husband, and that's where he struggles. And
you have to be a good dad. Like, you can be a cool dad and be a good dad,
and
too.
Still parent, like, as opposed to always making her the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one thing that I thought was missing from this, because I was like, I see bits of Marriage Story in this. I see bits of Eternal Sunshine. I see bits of 500 Days of Summer, of the good and the bad. And the one thing, even based on the plot synopsis that you read, was it talks about different phases of their life. But I feel like we really just see the beginning, and we see the last like 2 days before they presumably are going to get divorced, or at least start that process. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to see more of the middle of like how they changed over time, because we lead up to the wedding and then we jump to the day the dog dies and they're getting divorced in like 2 days later. So
I wonder how I agree with you. We don't get any of the messy middle. I wonder how much of that is intentional, though. And I didn't like read into it or anything, but I wonder how much of that is intentional to speak to more of that. This happened and we don't know how it happened, right? Like we don't know when and where this happened. And we felt it when it was exploding. We didn't see it when the fuse was lit. And like, I think of that in terms of, again, going back to my marriage and not trying to relate everything to that, but you do have a moment like that kind of at the end, or at least I certainly did, of like, I loved this person very much. And now not only do I not feel the same way, I don't know when it happened. I don't know when it shifted. Yeah. I don't know what was the thing that flipped the switch. I don't, you know, whatever, you're really like going through that. And I think the thing too is that, you know, you have these periods of like, you're very angry or you're fighting or you're sad or you're crying or whatever. And what I see in Michelle Williams' performance that I so identify with is you see her not necessarily, like, yes, she's still sad and yes, she's still mad and upset, but ultimately she's apathetic about this person. She's like, I have nothing, like there's literally nothing here for you anymore.
I don't know that having that middle part would add much to the film. It's more a curiosity of mine because, like I said, in the first half this, I wasn't picking up on a lot of the alcoholism stuff. I think I was taking notes. So I admit, like, Janelle was like, no, he had the beer can in this scene. He had the beer can in this scene. Like, clearly he's kind of like doing the least effort possible. I didn't pick up on it until Michelle Williams' character, I got to get their names right. So Cindy is cleaning up the house and he's just laying there. And I'm like, okay, I get what they're doing here, because she's doing all this stuff. She asks him to take out the garbage. He makes it seem like it's a big thing. And he's so focused on the wrong things. Like, he's focused on the intimacy. And like, in the beginning, I felt for him because he wants to show her affection, and selfishly he wants some for himself as well. He thinks he's solving the problem by doing this. But obviously by the time it gets to that shower scene, and it's just like, dude, she is not feeling this, and this is not what you need to be doing to fix this relationship. But he just doesn't seem to want to take no for an answer. That's when it turned for me.
Even just that scene where she's cleaning up and he's like not paying attention. They have a kid-free night and they're dealing with this loss of the dog, and he has turned it into his loss, not theirs.
Yeah. Yes.
So he's laying on the couch and he's watching old videos of her and the puppy, and he's so sad and put upon. And then you're the asshole if you say something to him about getting up and helping me, or getting up and like doing something around the house because he's mourning. Never mind that, yeah, you're mourning too, but you're running around trying to clean up the house before the kid gets home the next day and your job starts the next day and all these things. And so I think the lack of maturity is really resonant in all the future scenes, because he's criticizing everything that's not fun, not likable, not right. Like, you know, the oatmeal is with water and the this and the that, whatever. He has a criticism for everything that's not perfect, but he's not contributing to making it perfect. He didn't get his ass up and go make the oatmeal himself, right? He's just a critic. And then he thinks, like you said, that if they go to a sexy hotel and have sex one night, it's going to solve everything. It's the band-aid that's going to solve everything. And I think this is one of those situations where you have a mismatch too, of not just immaturity and growing up and taking your life seriously, but just misreading the what your partner needs from you, and what is the love language that they need from you right now. Like, she didn't need sex from you at that moment. She needed an act of service. She needed you to help her with something.
He should have read that Five Love Languages book. That's what he should have started with.
He should have started with it. Do you think that guy's ever finished a book in his life?
Maybe like a Dr. Seuss. Oh, he actually has a Shel Silverstein tattoo. So there we go. We know that he read the Giving Tree. So yeah. I wasn't going to mention that fact. It came up organically. I was like, that's not worth mentioning. But he does have, and The Giving Tree is this story about giving everything. So maybe he thinks that that's what he's doing. But yeah. But tying back to what you said at the very beginning of, you know, we always see the end of love stories in movies, and we always see this cocky, charming, like aloof, sweet male character winning over the girl. And it's like, if nothing changes in that man as a person 10, 15 years, it's gonna start to sort of run thin. Like, that bravado and that personality can only carry you so far, and we just don't see him growing up in this.
It's so true, because it's like, he is, and just to not rag on Dean the whole time, you know, early on, he is a sweetheart, and not just to her, like to people. You can tell he is a genuinely nice guy who cares about people, who wants to fall in love. He doesn't want to just get girls. You know, he's talking about like he wants to find the girl. And how do you know? And how do you find, you know, whatever. And he's kind to the elderly, which is something that, like, I just think is very underestimated. He wants this Walter man to have this beautiful room to come home to and decorates the room. Like, he's treating him like a whole person. You know what I mean? It's so easy to treat people at that age who are ill or a little bit not totally cognizant of what's going on as not full people. And he just has a whole conversation with him, and he even goes to take him back this locket. You know, he's like, hey, this is your locket. So he does things that show that he's kind, that he is romantic, that he is in many ways very genuine. He doesn't take himself too seriously, in the sense that, like, he doesn't seem super ambitious, but he's perfectly content to, like, work hard at that time. He's doing a shitty job. He's moving people around, and he'll do it, and that's fine. But like you said, it doesn't ever evolve past that. And I think that's the hard part, is like, he thinks he can just kind of live his whole life that way. And when you have a wife and you have a kid and you have different responsibilities, you don't get to just be the carefree guy. And I think that's a part of why he drinks so much, is like, how can he disconnect from the heavy weight of these responsibilities?
It's a coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
he didn't actually sign up for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he says that too, where he's like, I have a job where I get to drink at 8 a.m. or something like that. He says that later.
He's like, I'm living the dream. That just sounds like a lie you tell yourself.
It just rings hollow. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't, you don't buy it when he says that
conversation. This movie in the future scenes does such a good job of showing glimpses of how they still share some really intimate moments, and, you know, they make each other laugh on occasion. So there's little hints of that, but then it's interspersed. And I think they do a great job of weaving between really heart to heart, close conversations where they're kind of bonding. But then it goes into her saying, you know, why don't you do something? You have all these talents. You're so artistic. You're so creative, and you're just painting rooms every day. And that's when he gives his big speech. But this movie just takes you on this roller coaster ride of somber moments, followed by sort of not even fights, but just this uneasy conflict between them.
Yeah. Just a constant conflict. Yeah. Like, there's this uneasy conflict between them. And like you said, there's hints of those connections, but by and large, you're like, where did this go? And I think, you know, just speaking to the production of it a little bit as well, it was shot in different methods as well. So like the throwback content, so their pre-marriage scenes and even actually their wedding scene is shot on super 16 millimeter film. So it's a little bit grainier. I did notice
the past looked different compared to the current day. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's still like kind of traditional 16 millimeter, but it's super. So it's a little bit wider frame, but so it's a little bit less grainy than a typical 16 millimeter, but it still has graininess to it. And it's a little bit wider shot. It's like open, clean, pretty nostalgic look. It has this colored look to it that's different versus the current. The current shots, the most recent shots are done in Red One, which is like a digital camera, and it's much sharper. It's just, it's a very stark contrast in terms of the like prior scenes.
Washed out to me. It just looks kind of like a faded, you know, like a obviously sort of like a drab appearance to it.
And supposedly they also only used like practical lighting inside at that time. So I think that contributes to it. And then outside, I think they only had one light that they used in those outdoor scenes. So there's a lot of like shooting this as this is. And I think that hotel room is such a masterclass in how to shoot those scenes in close range.
Yeah.
And with that limited lighting and also giving that whole scene a certain feeling to it with the color and the tone and the darkness in there, and that there's no windows, like I don't think is unintentional, right? So it's this almost like intensive therapy session for them.
It's
in this
steel
room.
Cage match over
it's a
their
steel cage
relationship
match.
But it's just, we're going in here and we're gonna come out together or not, and we know how that ends. So but can I ask you something? I know this is like a delicate topic for you, so I don't, but tell me if you want to cut this question out. But if you had to choose, are you going to Cupid's Cove or are you going to the Future Room?
You know, that is a tough question. I was thinking that. I was like, you know, because like, does it, I know, I'm so rough. Give me a minute, guys. You know, I love a Star Wars moment. You know, I love a space theme. But what is Cupid's Cove? Are there like trees and hearts and I don't know, something
to be
like
fair, we
fairies.
Didn't get to see Cupid's Cove, so
we didn't. I think maybe I would pick that just because I didn't get to see it, you know, like now I want to know what that looks like. I'm like her, she's like, what does Cupid Cove look like?
I also don't know how I would feel about getting hammered and doing shots and then laying on a spinning bed. That seems like a
I
bad
know
idea.
What a choice. And like I'd be like, can you stop spinning the bed. And they're just
the other thing is when they that's again, maybe at that point, they're both kind of coping because they're drinking. And you kind of see how he is such a bad influence on. Not only is he not trying, but he's dragging her away when she knows she's on call to be there early the next morning. They're going 2 hours away. He's getting her to drink. And it's like they are having fun at that time. He's getting her to smoke, even though she says no. Like it's constantly just her being beaten and drilled into, even the sex thing. It's like he's persistent and persistent and persistent, and it's that like is something you hear from, you know, men who had sexual assault allegations in the last couple decades of, well, that's what we were taught from movies, pop culture, our dads, of you have to be persistent. Like girls, they want to maintain modesty, so they're going to keep saying no, and you have to keep just pressing. And in this, it just shows you how fucking creepy that is, not just with sex, but with anything of like, if she says no the first time, dude, just let it go. It's,
Yeah, this is not a masterclass in consent, certainly. And she, I just wanted to yank her out of there. You know, it's such a hard scene because, yeah, he's very persistent. She's very emotional at this point in the relationship. And even if she wants to have sex with him, like, let's just argue that maybe she does just for the physical need of it all. Mm-hmm. She's so blocked emotionally that she doesn't want this person touching her. And you see her just like ball her fists up. And that was so hard to see. Like, she wants to literally fight this somewhere in her subconscious. She wants to fight this. She either wants to hit him or she wants to break free.
Like, just getting the fucking point across.
And I just like, I just wanted to scream for her. Like, and just so many things too, where she's, like you said, it's just him beating her down over and over. Like, he beats her into down into going into this place, that going driving 2 hours away, and she doesn't want to do. And then she's got to go get the liquor so that they can go party in this hotel room. And then she meets this guy who was also a shithead in his own right, but whatever, yeah, is a source of conflict with her and her husband. And she tells him about it. And then he turns that into a thing. And then she's apologizing and saying, like, what are you apologizing for?
That was the one time where I was like, the Cindy character, if I were in her shoes, I would have played that differently, because we don't know what the situation is when that scene happens. We find out later, right, what exactly the situation was with Bobby, played by Mike Vogel, who I remember from Cloverfield. He had a small part in that. He was also, mm-hmm, in the 2003 Texas Chainsaw. So I got to bring the horror references to the pod.
But he's also in Sex Life, ironically, on Netflix. So
it sounds like something I need to watch. but we don't know the circumstances. And when she sees him in the store, it's like, okay, there's history here. We can read into that. He's very handsome at this point in his, yep, life compared to Gosling. He's got very nice arms. I can compliment, mm-hmm, another man's arms. But when they're in the vehicle, I think Dean makes Cindy laugh. They're having this casual conversation, and she sort of drops it in a humorous moment. It's like, you'll never guess who I saw in the store. Who?
No.
This guy that, like, we had unprotected sex. I asked him not to do this. He did. I got pregnant. I almost had an abortion. Him and his friends kicked the shit out of you. That was the only time. I was like, I don't know how else you address that, because it probably would have been a fight no matter what. But to be like, guess who I saw, and expect him to be like, why the fuck are you like, that was the one time where I was like, Cindy, I might have.
In the moment, it's not a great interaction, because, yeah, you feel like he's overreacting. In the moment, you're, right, like, he's taking it too far.
Yeah.
He's just jealous. And like, she's just bringing up this thing in passing that happened, big whoop, right?
Yeah.
And then you see the real result of that whole prior situation that you said, and like how it extrapolates out to have very real consequences on their current life. Like,
yeah,
it is very much implied that the baby is this man's baby,
yeah,
not Dean's. And it is possible that it's his, but it's unlikely given the timing. And so you just said that you saw the biological parent of our daughter in, yeah, the liquor store, and you made it seem like not a big deal. But at that moment, it feels like she's just apologizing for everything. She can't do anything right. She's, you know, like there's a no-win situation. And I think it's shot that way on purpose too.
And maybe it's like, she's not doing anything maliciously, because I think we've established that this character is, I hesitate to use the word submissive. That sounds really mean, but it just, we see her history of men that she's dated, starting with this guy. And it's like, this doesn't seem like a loving relationship. So like, maybe she is sort of just telling men what she thinks they want to hear. Cause even the interaction in the liquor store, I was like, she's awfully friendly with this dude. And it's like, oh, how have you been? Blah, blah, blah. And then when we find out what happened, it's like, this is fucked up.
You're like,
up.
How did you even acknowledge this guy? Like, yes, fuck this guy. Yeah.
And the fact that she's casual. And again, maybe it's just, she thinks that's what her husband would want to know. Like, hey, I'm going to be honest with you and tell you this, try to make it light, even though I know you're going to be pissed no matter what. So maybe that's, again, not on her.
Well, I don't think it's actually a bad thing, or actually incorrect to say that she is submissive. I think you have to take into account the home in which she grew up. And that is, yeah, briefly shown to us a few times. You know, her dad is very verbally abusive to her mom, and she is directly exposed to that on a daily basis. And it borders on violent. There's implications that it's not, yeah, physically violent to her mom, but it's verbally abusive, certainly. And he is violent around them. And so if you are afraid of somebody being violent around you, which I have been in that situation, you will not be like yourself. You will not say the thing that you want to say, because you go into flight or fight survival mechanisms, you know? And so I think she has taught herself that this is a survival mechanism to specifically appease the men around her, because they are the threat,
yeah,
you know? And so I think she saw Bobby as a threat. He then goes and beats her new boyfriend. Like, so he's proven that again, you know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
And Dean has never been that way to her that we've seen, but this is something that really hurts him. There's no good way to talk about it. How does she just has to apologize. She just has to apologize. She just has to apologize. And so I think those instances are her very much just being passive for a reason as a form of self-protection. I think that's
and I mean,
part of how she sees it.
Dean, it's more of an emotional abuse, and maybe it's some of it we do see where it's direct and insulting and mean, and others it's just that withdrawn, putting zero effort in. So she's getting it from both angles. When he does the, when they're, I can't remember the exact sequence of events, but it's like he's trying to have sex again. She's saying no. And then he starts saying, like, you want me to hit you? You want me to hit you? And I was like, this is, now we're really at a dark place.
And he says the R word, which I'm not going to say, but he also says, do you want me to R word you?
Everything and after that was so hard. Like, what after that, all the flashbacks to the quote unquote happy moments are so hard to watch knowing that this is where it's going.
Yeah. And it's extra hard because it's a little bit rooted in, like, what he says is not necessarily wrong, or not necessarily wrong, but just what he says is not necessarily inherently bad, where he's like, I don't want to just have sex with your body. Like, I don't just want your body. I want to have a relationship. I want to have actual intimacy with you is what he's saying, which is, in theory, again, a big part of Dean being romantic. But the problem is, again, he's not seeing or getting any of the cues of what could be actual intimacy for them, what could actually build those connections. And it's kind of all about him, you know, what does Dean want? What does Dean need?
I deserve affection. Yeah.
Right. I deserve affection. And so if there's anything that's a turnoff in that moment where you're trying to get there potentially for your partner, him being like, I deserve this. No. You know, that's not how this works. And yeah, you see that devolve and it kind of comes to a head the next day. You know, she does, of course, has to be on call, has to go to work, freaking hungover, poor woman, and be a nurse, which is not an easy job. Mm-mm. And she's doing her best work. She's doing a good job. And then you find out that yet another man in her life is trying to take advantage of her in yet another way.
False pretenses.
Oh, I want you to come move your family to this great job opportunity. It's a promotion for you in this new town and blah, blah, blah. Oh, but also maybe if your family didn't come, that would be great. And you could just, we could hang out. Like what in the actual fuck? Like if this movie couldn't get more depressing and angering, that's the fucking cherry on top.
There's not
I was
a
like,
single, it's like,
there's not a single good dude in this movie.
I was
going
to say, it's the opposite of the movies where all the female characters feel ancillary to the story and it's just all the dudes are cool and all the women suck. I feel like a lot of Judd Apatow movies get criticized. That's a critique they get. In this, it's the opposite. There's not a single good male character in this film. They all suck.
No. And they have, what I will say is that they're not one dimensional. So we'll give them that. Yeah. Like at least they've written. And I think that's again, a credit to the writers in the room, but you know, the men here who are flawed are not one dimensional. They have redeeming qualities. You know, even her dad, who's terrible, Jerry, he seemingly is a good grandpa and loves his granddaughter. You know,
I also cut Jerry a little bit of slack, not to make light of it, but if I were dealing with Detective McNulty at work every day on the wire and I had to come home, I would probably be kind of pissed. I wouldn't throw food or criticize my wife's cooking, but I'd probably be a little moody too.
A little grumpy.
And also I have to take it back. Walter's a pretty cool guy. He's the only good guy in the movie. So
Walter is a cool dude. He has some cool swag, man. The matchbooks all over the wall. Got a handsome uniform, you know? Yeah, we love Walter. Walter is not to blame. But yeah, the rest of them suck in their own ways for sure.
In regards to the fight where he's saying over and over again, you want me to hit you, you want me to hit you. I was like, there's multiple times in this movie where the dialogue gets repetitive. And some of that you can kind of attribute to Dean's alcoholism and just inability to communicate. I think other parts of it were, I didn't know this until after watching it, that a lot of this was improvised and their conversations. And I think that's why it feels so authentic. And it's in real life, you are not as clever as most people in television and film. You do repeat yourself when you're fighting, like you have these moments. So I noticed that throughout and then seeing that fact after that, they were encouraged to just improv.
Yeah, they improved a lot of things. They improved the there was a bridge scene where, you know, he's trying to get her to reveal what's
the
problem.
How did you read that? The first time you saw this, that bridge scene, were you like, oh, this is so whimsical and funny that he's pretending to do this to get... Or did you read it as this is another way of him forcing her to feel uncomfortable to get what he wants out of her?
I think the first time you see it as whimsical and funny because you don't really know the results of this conversation. This is still in a like a romance phase for them. And so you don't really know where it's going. You think, I mean, you know, because you've seen what's going on with her, but you don't think that he knows anything really sinister is going on. And so he just is, it seems like he's playing around.
Right.
But later, it definitely, if on rewatch, it's like, it feels like a yet another emotionally manipulative move on his part to get her to do what he wants. But it also, I think more importantly, is just indicative of his inability to have a serious and mature conversation, right? He can't just pull her aside, take her and take his hand, you know, and grab her and say, hey, I know that something's wrong and I want to be able to help. So I would love if you would trust me enough to share with me what's wrong. You know, like,
yeah,
that's all you needed to say, right? And instead, he has to go to these like antics to get her to engage with him. And I think it's just, again, it's his immaturity and it stays that way. You know, he continues to do that throughout their relationship. This hotel room is an antic, right? This is a shtick. Let me pull a thing and like, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of the hat if I do this. And
it's a Hail Mary.
It's a Hail Mary.
Let's save this marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, to your point about their dialogue and like their improv back and forth, I mean, they really built that up. They actually lived in a house together in preparation for the film where they like rented a little house and they had to buy things within the budget of their characters. And they lived in this house for 30 days. And they were like, having to share a bathroom and having to do dishes, and they were trying to interact with each other and find ways to like pick at each other. And so I think that they really bonded in that very method setting and got really comfortable with the way that they were going to interact with each other and talk to each other throughout, and feels like a mini marriage in real practice.
The biggest compliment I can give this film is it feels authentic. At least the future stuff, the modern day stuff, feels like what a real relationship would feel like if you were sort of on your last legs and resenting each other in that way. I'll say the stuff when they're younger, most of that feels authentic too. The one thing I didn't need in 2010 was like a speech about, do you believe in love at first sight? That feels a little out of place in this movie of all the stuff for a movie that seems rooted in reality. I didn't really need Ryan Gosling to be like, do you believe in love at first sight? That seemed a little rom-commy to me.
I think it's just him being, I think it's, it is rom-commy, but I think it is very like his character, you know? I think it vibes with this like hopeless romantic guy that where they're trying to show us who he is, and he's just trying to figure it out. And like we've seen, he doesn't know how to figure these things out. And so he's asking an older dude, like, you know, because he's also surprised at how obsessed he is with her is, I think, what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. He saw her and he can't stop thinking about her. And he's like, well, this has got to be what it is. Because yet again, the immaturity kicks in of like, well, if I'm still thinking about her, then clearly I'm in love with her. You know, so like he's just not that mature. And so it doesn't surprise me. I do think it's the most rom-commy thing in the movie, but it doesn't necessarily surprise me for him as a character at all.
Yeah, I wanted to, it's not, no, not shocking. And I wanted to touch on some of the flashback stuff because I really like their interactions. I forget at what point in the movie it's happening, but they do the bus ride and that sort of conversation. And we get that really inappropriate, but very funny pedophile joke. It's weird to say out of my mouth, but it made me laugh. I have a fucked up sense of humor. So
it does make you laugh, but it's a fucked up joke. But it's like you're also aware of how fucked up it is while you're laughing at it, for sure. Yeah.
Apparently that was also improvised. Like that was something that, I mean, not that I don't think Michelle Williams thought of that joke on the spot, but Ryan Gosling didn't know what joke she was going to tell. So that's a genuine reaction. But that scene afterward, when they're walking the streets, and I think it's a one shot. I didn't pick up on it until like a couple of minutes in, but when he's got the ukulele and they do the little dance number and he's singing in front of the store, I think that's all a one shot. That scene's fucking adorable, but it's again, hard to be fully happy when you know how it's going to end.
Well, it just feels like all the hope of their relationship is captured in that moment. It's so beautiful. Yeah. And they're connecting in such a beautiful way, and they're like being vulnerable with each other in a really sweet way. And you're like, this can only go up from here. Like, this is going to turn into something gorgeous and lovely. And you are just, it is juxtaposed so hard against the very first scene where you know that that is not the case. And it's, so you're just, it's extra heartbreaking again when you see these beautiful moments. And, but I will say, like, some of the other moments, I know we don't get the full messy middle or anything, but some of the other moments that are still shot in this like 60 millimeter nostalgic film, to me, do feel like some of the cracks, like the beginning of the cracks, you know? Yeah. And I don't know if that's a rewatch thing or if it's just, it's supposed to be there, but I, you know, he chooses, having never wanted to have kids, he says that a couple of times, that that's like not a big priority to him, to save her. And I say it that way on purpose, like in quotes, because it seems like that's what he's doing more than he's opting in to be a parent. Not that he doesn't love his daughter. He obviously loves his daughter. Later on, you see it manifest like that's his daughter. But when he makes the decision, it's about saving her from being sad. He sees her crying. He sees her sad. He thinks about it for a whopping 30 minutes on the way home from the clinic. It's impulsive. It's let's do this. And then it becomes, that's the thing that he's romanticizing, right? Mm-hmm. Our little family is the new romance. Our little family is going to be the new romantic story. And they're still in their little bubble when they're at the courthouse getting married alone. No one is there. No one is supporting them. And they look like they're in this just sweet little bubble of happiness. And when you know how much, again, work marriage takes and how much of a community you need and all the things, that actually looks very isolating. And
I was going to say the fact, yeah, that's a great call out that I didn't pick up on, but them being alone at the wedding and then the life that they have as adults. I mean, I keep saying that. I feel like only 6 years pass between because the kid is what, 6, 8 years old in this?
Yeah, it's like seven years ish.
So it's less than a decade. But they seem to live off on their lonesome. We don't see any friend characters really. We see some coworkers and her dad, and that's it. That's their social life.
Yeah. And I think like, it makes sense that she's getting value and she's getting reprieve at work, right? Because this is completely separated from this thing. And it's also maybe the only lifeline, you know, at this juncture.
Also love that her coworkers have her back when he walks in and the receptionist is like, you must be Dean, and says it in the most passive aggressive.
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, this is her reprieve from that relationship. And these people know what's going on. She's told them, you know, she's bitched about him a lot, and they probably all want her to leave her shitty husband as far as they're concerned. And then he shows up in the worst way. Right. And it's not how he is all the time necessarily, but this is the worst way. Yeah. So yeah, it's to see those worlds kind of come to a head is, I think, maybe one of the many things that really just triggers her into like, this was the one thing I had. This was the one place I had away from you and away from this. And I was valued here and I was supported here, and you just fucking upended it. Like, I'm done. And I think that I've been through similar experiences of somebody damages irreparably something that was a safe haven for you. Mm-hmm. And it being the thing that just really opens your eyes and says like, no, like I now have nothing. And so this can't go on, you know,
the final fight scene in the clinic or whatever it is, the hospital. And they juxtapose it. If I remember correctly, it's kind of going back and forth between the wedding and this, and we're seeing the day they're married, and we're seeing the day they're probably again going to start their divorce proceedings. But that whole scene goes on for so much longer than I thought it would. And it just lets you sit there in the awkwardness, in the cringe. And between that and the shower scene, I think those were the two parts of the movie where I was just uncomfortable, and you're just waiting for it to end. And it feels real because it doesn't escalate to the point if you're watching a regular movie, you assume it's going to escalate to a specific thing. That doesn't happen. He does end up striking her boss, which loses her job. But yeah, just those two scenes just made me feel icky.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to too. And it's like also makes you think about
what has happened to them? Like, what has happened to their respective selves too, to get them here? Like, she wanted to be a doctor, and mm-hmm. them deciding to have a child, which is obviously not something they regret in that sense, but it hindered that, right? So she doesn't get to be what she wants to be. She wants him, Mr. Talented and extroverted mm-hmm. and charming, to mm-hmm. do something almost on behalf of her, right? Like, do something. And then you see how much their relationship has become about this, like, day to day, and how hard it is. And they're not themselves anymore. Like, she's not this happy, ambitious, intellectual, hopeful woman that we see at the beginning. And he's also not really fully this romantic, happy-go-lucky guy either. He's putting on that facade as much as he can, but he's not really. So neither of them are the person that they fell in love with, and that's the reality. They've grown into these different people, and some people can grow together, and they don't, and they made each other worse versions of themselves. That's what I see in it, and like, that's what I realize, what I related to watching it. That is very hard to see, because you're like, I think about how I was at that moment in this relationship for me, and I was the absolute worst version of myself. And it's, you have to pull yourself out of it to become the best version of yourself. And so, like, as devastating as this whole thing is, and it's terrible to watch, it's probably the beginning of something that is going to be so much better for them both. And I know it's like very hard to find that spin here, but that's the only thing that I think can get you through this movie. Of like, yeah, they're going to be better for this decision that they've made, while very hard, is probably better for both of them. You know,
I agree. So you read it and I think the safe assumption is, yes, they're getting a divorce. That's how you read it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he's realizing that she's given, like, that she's done. Even if he's not done, she's done. But I think he's also kind of realizing that he's done. Yeah. You know, I think, like, when they have that fight in the kitchen, you know, I'm just like, to me, and I can't remember what it was that he did that triggered it. Maybe it was like the slamming the door frame, but there was something that he did that I was like, he knows. Like, yeah, he knows. You know, mm-hmm. and then he walks off and he tells the kiddo to go back. And that's extra heartbreaking, because you know he loves her. And I don't think it's implied that he's not going to still be her dad. But I think it's emblematic of, he is losing his family. I think you're supposed to see that he's losing his family, which is the thing that he really ended up choosing for his life, to be a family guy. That he says that over and over again. And so I think it's indicative of a real loss of identity for him. And probably also why he's been holding on to it so hard, even though it hasn't been working.
Yeah. I don't know what the lesson of this film is. Is it that love is hard? Is it that you gotta always, like, put in the work to make a marriage work? Just because I think that, you know, and this is coming from somebody who hasn't been in a lot of long-term relationships, but I think that when you share your life with somebody else on the regular day-to-day, you're constantly, like, I do think you become a different version of yourself a little bit. It's like my social butterfly-ness, yeah, when I'm dedicating part of that to one person on the regular, I'm not the exact same person I used to be when I could sit at home for 10 hours a day and then go hang out with my friends and be at an 11, mm-hmm, you know? So mm-hmm, I think it's understandable and it makes sense that both people give up little parts, you know?
Yeah.
You compromise a little bit, but you're also willing to put in the work to keep the other person happy and to continue to be the best version of yourself that you can be. Whereas in this, it just feels like he has kind of given up and he's like, well, this is my fucking life now. I guess I'm happy with it. And he's drinking to get through the day, yeah, you know?
I don't know if there's a great lesson other than, I do think they make compromises that were too far. Mm. And I think maybe that's what you're supposed to flag in yourself. And that was certainly true of my marriage, of like, I shouldn't even gotten married. Like, I mean, no, and I don't mean that because of the person. I mean, I am not a marriage person. I know this about myself now, right? I knew that about myself before, but I compromised it. And I think he was not a family guy. He was not somebody who wanted to be just a husband and a father. That was not going to be his only identity. He didn't know what it was yet, but he didn't have time to find out. And he just opted into this thing, right? And I think when you know something about you at your core, even though you really love someone, and that can be true, you can't change that about yourself for them, because right. that is not sustainable. You know, you can't yeah. change for them just because you love them. You have to be who you are and love them, and that works or it doesn't work. And same thing for her. She gave up things. She compromises over and over again. We see it throughout. And I think they compromised too far, where there just wasn't a tether anymore. There wasn't a tether of themselves. And
resentment as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the good news for you is if you're not a marriage person, you'll never have the situation from Ready or Not, to reference another movie from Rose. So that's good.
But no, like, hunt on the wedding night. I'll be fine.
I wanted to say I got two last things in my notes really quick as we wrap up. First off, Cindy, she has a line where she says, "How are you able to compliment and insult at the same time? It's called negging. Read a book, Cindy." but you have such nice eyes. Anyway, and then the other thing was, I was watching him play. What's that instrument where it's like the toy piano, but it has the thing that you blow into? What's that called?
I don't even know what that's called.
I don't know if that's a vocoder that you put in there. It's from that. Remember that Bon Jovi, "It's My Life" song?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think it's something with that, but it's a piano. I was like, is this how Gosling got to teach all of us jazz in La La Land? You know, how nobody knew about jazz until the white man showed up. I was like, maybe this was the inspiration.
Well, it certainly, you know, you do see those threads of his Mickey Mouse Club coming through.
Oh,
he's
hell
been,
yeah.
He's been slowly showing us all of his skills throughout all of his film. La La Land was, you know, just the culmination, just the culmination of it all.
And then if there's a super random fact that I couldn't fit anywhere else in the episode, any Office fans out there, there's a little, the license plate on Cindy's car is the same license plate that Jim Halpert has on The Office. I don't know if
like the actual numbers are the same.
The state and the license plate itself. I don't know how that works in big motion pictures, but they have the same.
Is this like a prop license plate that makes the rounds?
Maybe it's like the 555 thing with phone numbers. Right. Maybe there's like two total license plates in movies and we're all just not noticing, you know?
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Okay. Well, you know, it is shot in Scranton, so checks out.
See?
So there you go. Well, all right, guys. Thanks for hanging in through the most depressing thing ever. Really quick, what's your rating? What would you rate it?
I'll keep it short and sweet. Really good performances. Bummer of a fucking movie. I don't know if I ever want to watch it again.
I'm interesting pretty done
with it. Interesting one-time experience. I'm trying to not mix the personal experience and how it made me feel with the quality of the film. But I think I'm going to go 7.5. Just... that's where my gut tells me.
Yeah, my gut check was a 7. Yeah. So I'm with you. It's very well made. Performances mm-hmm. are strong. I really respect the work that went into this in all the ways. And it's just almost too relatable. And I'm like, it just hurts to watch. But it's very well done. And I just, wouldn't watch it again. Just like I would never watch Marriage Story ever again. No, thank you. Very well done, but never again. All right,
I'm glad we at least got a few laughs in today. I didn't think we were going to get any humor out of this one, but
I didn't think so either. Even if just because I don't feel well at all. So thanks for cheering me up a little bit, surprisingly, with this really sad movie. But anyways, thanks for joining us. Come back next week for a whole new month where this will hopefully be a lot more fun than this one. This particular episode was
dumb fun.
This is going to be action! Exclamation point! April. Exclamation point, because get it? Action, y'all. Okay, see what I did there? All right, we are starting things off with an incredible classic from action, The French Connection, one of Gene Hackman's best, and we thought also timely because of his recent passing, wanted to give a little homage to the legend Gene Hackman. And I forget, have you seen this one?
I've never
you
seen
not,
French
right?
Connection, nope.
Okay, well, look forward to one of the best car chases of all time. So it's a good time. But in the meantime,
follow us on our socials, Instagram mainly, TikTok. We're trying to be more active on there. Remember, you can also see the video portion of the podcast either on Spotify or on YouTube. Give us a subscribe, likes, comments, all that good stuff. Mackenzie's doing a good job of replying to comments and whatnot on YouTube. I forget to go there sometimes. I do my best.
Yeah, so be nice, because I'm the only one looking at those most of the time. But thanks for checking us out there. It's been a lot of engagement there, so appreciate it. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers to Gatorade.
And if you're sick, drink Gatorade.